Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Hello and welcome to Brenton Cliff Flea Circus. My name is Cliff.
Hello, and my name is Brett.
Well, welcome you, Brett.
Welcome
Merry Christmas
you, Cliff.
And that.
Yes, Merry Christmas
we're in between,
to you.
Aren't we? We're in between.
Yeah, it's that strange time in between Christmas and New Year, isn't it?
I think
where
it's
where you
great
just
time.
Get pissed.
I'm off work.
Well, that's it. You've got an excuse, haven't you? You can do that sort of stuff. That's good. So I inebriated at the moment, Paul?
Well, I've been out for a few beers today for the last 8 hours.
Ah, yes, so.
I'm all right. To be honest, Brett, I started with shandies.
Did you? You've been a good boy. And then it just descended into...
No, I'm all right. I'm all right. I've paced myself tonight because I knew we'd be out up on this and out a little bit late talking about this tonight. So... I paced myself a bit. I lovely fish and chips in the pub.
Nice. Did you ask for a shandy or did you ask for a lager top?
Well, I'll tell you what I did. I ordered pints and Sprite on the side. Because it's a lager top, they don't know what you're on about here, to be honest.
So. Don't know what you're on about.
To be honest, I'll say shandy. It was more like three lager tops than three shandies.
Three lager tops.
It wasn't strictly half and half. But, you know, the lovely, like when you... You're having a pint at 1 p.m. like it, you know, you don't want to go straight in with the hard stuff necessarily, do you? So
no, you don't. So you didn't have a Shane McGowan like we did that Christmas time. No. I remember we heard that you like Guinness with a double whiskey in it.
Yes,
and I'm
not surprised that it did because it got you very drunk very quickly.
So. It certainly did.
Christmas has been nice here and the family's all fine. I hope yours has as well.
Yes, absolutely fine. Thanks
I haven't
for
really
asking,
done
yes.
much other than the Christmas.
Well, I'm just shattered now. I need another week off to bloody sort myself out, I think. Do you know what I mean? I'm just absolutely shattered. That's a problem, isn't it? You've got that puzzled look on your face again, you can't, yes?
No, that's it. Like, you know, it takes a lot out of you. You've got to be nice to everyone. Lots of people say hello to and all of that. And, you know, it is one of those things. Like, it's a great time of year, I think. Mm-hmm. But, you know, there's lots to do. Lots of people to keep happy and be happy for and all of that. So,
I suppose so. Hey, Cliff, did you hear about that actress that got stabbed last night? The one that's in Legally Blonde, what's her name? Reese.
With a spoon?
No, it was with a knife.
What a lovely joke about a lady getting stabbed.
I thought you'd like that one.
I haven't really watched out on the telly. I haven't listened to much. I've been, other than the Beatles, which is what we're going to talk about. And unless you want to do any more small talk, we're going to get into the Beatles Get Back, which is an 8.5-hour opus, as most, I guess, a lot of our listeners will know. It's a three-part series about the recording of the Let It Be album, but it's an expansion of the Let It Be film which came out to accompany the album in 1970. Uh-huh. But Peter Jackson has taken so much more footage that was available and basically done a documentary kind of about the documentary.
Uh-huh. Apparently there was like 60 hours or something like that.
I think the last bit says like slate 500, take whatever, and then it kind of leaves out like there's a lot of footage, a lot of audio, and a lot of studio shenanigans that I think probably wasn't necessary. But we'll get into that as we
necessary
talk about
for us.
So we're going to welcome, I'm just going to send him the invite, but we're going to welcome Luke, our mm-hmm. good friend from the Mariners, on to talk about it. Another huge Beatles fan. He's a massive McCartney fan, isn't he? So I'm looking forward to hearing what he thinks about this. I've spent a while watching it. It was a couple of weeks ago, wasn't it, when I first said I started it, and I wasn't so sure about it mm-hmm. at that point. And
I think you said it annoyed you.
It did, and I stand by that. I think it was kind of on purpose a bit, but we'll talk about when Luke comes on. But I think it's in those three parts. The first part, uh-huh. in my opinion, is the annoying part. The second part is the best part, and then the third part is the concert.
That's interesting now, because I think that the first part is the best part.
Do you really?
And the second part slightly annoyed me, which is a bit odd.
I don't think we can be friends anymore.
Well, at least we can agree on the fact that the third part is the concert.
Is it the concert, though? Yes, it is.
Yes. Yes, it is. Yes, it is. It's definitely the concert at the end, isn't it? But I thought, I loved it, mate. I thought it was great overall.
It's long.
But I preferred, it is long, yeah. But I mean, people want the 60-hour version, aren't they? The director's cut. So there you go. That would be even better, wouldn't it?
There he is. Nice to see you. You've grown a little Christmas beard, I think. A more of a beard.
A maca beard.
Yeah, this for this.
A maca beard.
So we've just done a little introduction and said that we're going to have a couple episodes talking about The Beatles Get Back by Peter Jackson. Mm-hmm. I don't know where we're going to end this one and start the next one, but what we will do is play a couple of your songs at the end of both of them, which is great, or you and the Mariners songs. And now we were just getting into that. It's a three-part series. It's on for fucking ages. And it's a treasure trove of stuff for Beatles fans like us. Uh-huh. We're all huge Beatles fans. What I want to do before we get into the minutiae of it, which we can't do too much because we'd be on for hours, is your initial thoughts on it. Luke, you've watched it. I know you've watched it twice. What's your top line review of it?
It's the best thing that's been on television since Anthology. I'd argue it's not long enough. It's like I think I've watched it three times now completely, and then I've also dipped into bits just like for half hour here and there sort of thing, and I have it on the background sometimes. I just wish it was just constant. I wish they'd done it in real time, so you had like literally 24 hours just following each of them just for that 3 or 4 weeks. That'd have been better.
Luke's review is too short.
Yeah, too short. 8.5 hours, not enough. Brett, what's your initial top line? What do you think?
I think it's history, isn't it? You know what I mean? That's the thing about it. It's like the documentary that Peter Jackson did before this as well, about the World War One and stuff like that. That's history as well, isn't it? And this theme, it's absolutely... I loved it. I mean, again, there were certain parts of it I like better than the other parts, for mm-hmm. example, like we've just talked about, the first part are like the best. That's my one.
For some reason.
You like the second one? For some reason. But it's history. It's, if you're a Beatles fan, like you said, it's a treasure trove, isn't it?
Yeah, I think
it's better than the Beatles talking to each other, even if they're not getting on.
I think it's absolutely revelatory being able to get this insight into what this process was. Mm-hmm. And what they're trying to do is revelatory as well. And I think without this, Let It Be in this process is overlooked. Let It Be is my least favorite Beatles album, probably. We've talked about that before. Yeah. It probably still is, like, maybe, maybe not. But just watching this is, I mean, you're right, you're watching history. You could watch it for hours. Like, you could have it on for 21 days or 27 days, whatever it is. But at the same time, I do think there's bits that are repetitive. I do think there's bits that are annoying, but that's all part of it, isn't it? That's part of what they're trying to show you, this process of what they were getting up to was. I think it's a brilliant piece of work from Peter Jackson, but what I can't understand is how has it taken 50 years? I was just about to say that.
Have these tapes just been sat there for 50 years and no one... What I don't get, because they obviously do cash in on a lot of Beatles stuff every now and then. Mm-hmm. They could have cashed in on this after 20 years, 30 years, 40 years. It's taken this long to sort of think, oh, this might be worth doing something with this.
which is
crazy, really. I can understand why it didn't come out in the 90s with obviously the anthology in that. But in the years that have passed, it's just been sat there.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But I think the part of it is that Peter Jackson used that technology, whatever he did with that war film. I haven't watched it, but I've read that he's been able to restore the footage using that technology, which maybe that wasn't possible before. So before, maybe it would have just been loads more grainy, miserable footage like the original film was, which maybe wouldn't have added anything new. It would have still looked a bit crap. I don't know. That's the only thing I can think of that they didn't do it before. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, because it looks amazing. It looks like it could have been filmed last week, doesn't it?
Technicolor, isn't it? It's like one of those old 50s or 60s films that filmed in like Technicolor. Like it's proper popping out of the screen, the outfits and all of that, which it that adds to it so much. Like what they're wearing and how they look and the contrast. One of the main things I think is the contrast between them and Glyn Johns and everybody else. and what they're wearing, because they are like aliens. I know we've said this before, but they're existing in their own bubble, and in this, even more in their own bubble than before.
And everyone else is a bit square, aren't they? Compared to them,
totally square. Yeah. Like all when you're watching the people,
even some of the younger ones, apart from Glyn Johns, even the younger ones that are like knocking about, the studio technicians, people that were probably quite young and hip at the time, they're still very square.
No one's got George's shoes, have they? I mean, George said that he doesn't go to shoe shops or whatever. So he'll get some shoes.
He's got some lovely shoes.
What are them shoes that he's got on them things?
The ones like at the end where they just show you them tapping when they're listening to the final playback. You're like,
when he asked someone to bring some in for him, he was only asking for plain black slip-ons. You're like, when do you wear plain black slip-ons?
Do you think that George is a bit of a diva because he was asking for dicky bow ties?
He's a massive diva. I think that's one of the main things of the film is George being this sensitive soul on his journey to spiritual enlightenment, but also being a total diva. And I think George is my favorite, right? I absolutely love him, but he's such there's two sides to him. He's so pious and so kind of uppity and angry about stuff, and at the same time preaching peace and love, and you've got to embrace everything. But that's life, right? Like that's the human condition, which is why I think John Lennon's exactly the same. And I think, you know, that's what makes you relate to these people, even though they're on another time, on another level to all of us, really.
He's also the most sensible out of a lot of them, isn't he?
I think he's brilliant.
This is ridiculous.
Yeah, this is
I'm not spending 2 weeks on a boat with people.
I love the bit at the end where they're like, George, do you want to go on the roof? And he goes, obviously, I don't want to go on the roof.
He doesn't want to do anything, George.
He wants to do nothing but play the guitar, which is great. I think it's great.
As long as you turn that pedal off, then it's great. Some of that early stuff at Twickenham where he's got that pedal on, it's a little bit too forceful for my liking on that.
I agree with you, but I think George's story. Right, Michael Lindsay Hogg, horrible. I think everybody who's watched this must think, what a dick that guy is.
What did he bring to it?
Nothing. Absolutely nothing. Well,
there's the board thing, isn't there? There's also the idea that you've boarded. Shall we go to a hospital? Not for really sick kids, just ones we're broken.
Just a little sick. Just a little bit sick.
He just keeps going, 2,000 Arabs.
Yeah, he came up with some shit ideas, didn't he?
They keep. I mean, they don't even acknowledge most of them, and he's still there. He's a dick. He doesn't respect their kind of genius and who they are, and he's no one. That's what pisses me off more than anything. There's a bit where he goes, all we've got so far is a film about tea drinkers, nose pickers, and nail biters, and nobody responds to it at all.
I couldn't believe the bit where he was trying to sell himself as well as being like the biggest Beatles fan in the world, and he sat there trying to tell Linda that he's a bigger fan than what she is. They think you are, pal. It's like
he's a total fraud, isn't he? He's like so transparent. He just wants to, he's in this to make a name for himself, right? Like, there's no other reason he's doing this whatsoever. He's not very creative. For a start, he had all of this footage and made the shittest film of all time out of it. So, and there's one bit where he goes, there's no story. Mate, you've got one of the Beatles leaving and coming back. You've got another fella turning up and joining the Beatles. You've got, like, they're doing a thing on the rooftop, like, there's a story here. Like, I don't understand how you're a filmmaker and don't see that these things all are the arc of a story of a thing.
Think John tells him that at one point, doesn't he? Like, he said something about the story, and John says, "I think it's all kicking off." And I pull out the nods. We're like, "Yeah, this is crazy. This is a good documentary." Yeah, he just doesn't see it himself, does he?
I think the main thing with this whole thing is it's totally aimless, isn't it? That's what he's getting at. But he's the director. He should be fucking directing it. But there's this kind of, it's a fly on the wall. We're just going to see what happens. And the Beatles don't work like that. The Beatles, I think one of the main things, out of all of the genius that's on show here, they are not a jam band. They cannot just jam and, other than Paul McCartney on his own, making Get Back out of thin air. They can't just jam, which is obviously fucking phenomenal, but they're not like a band that can jam like that, you know, which a lot of bands in the late 60s could do, just play for ages and make something out of nothing. But this entire project is kind of about that, which is why I think it is so frustrating and lasted, even though it's only 21 days. That's a long time for Beatles to be recording an album.
I mean, they just revert back to the oldies, don't they? Whenever they're bored, they just revert back to old rock and roll and stuff like that. Like they would have Paul McCartney.
That was kind of the point, wasn't it? But I don't know. It's just weird.
I loved all that, me. I like listening to the German stuff.
No, I'm not having it. I'm not having a go at what it sounds like, but it's not what they're best at, is it?
No, I agree with that.
What do you think, Luke?
I mean,
well, you've got to remember as well, they just spent the last two or three albums sort of advancing music for not just themselves but everybody in the world, and now all of a sudden they were trying to go back to something that was so old-fashioned, really, in a sense, that the whole thing of like, let's get in a room, just knock an album out in a day or in a morning or whatever, it was a little bit, all of a sudden, a little bit alien to them, and it was probably taking them, well, it was taking them out of the comfort zone. Their comfort zone then was a studio, be it Abbey Road or wherever, where they've got George Martin and all their engineers at their whim doing all these amazing things. All of a sudden they were gone straight away from that. It was like, right, let's do something raw, no overdubs, no layering stuff up. It must have been quite a strange experience.
Yep.
And a pressure as well to all of a sudden go back to that.
Yeah, what do you think, Brett?
It's definite pressures, isn't it? Because they've got a certain amount of time to do this, because originally it was like a TV show that they were going to do or whatever, and then that evolved into a documentary and stuff like that. So there's the pressure there. I think it's also Paul McCartney's idea, isn't it? It's his sort of
baby. So you have an idea at that point, I suppose.
But it's to like bring the band back together, isn't it? Because they're in trouble.
Yeah, well, that's they've come thing. After the White Album, which they all recorded separately, right?
Yeah.
Magical Mystery Tour didn't go down very well. That was all McCartney's idea. White Album, they recorded separately, pretty much, or wrote separately, and then it's all kind of solo songs on that. And this was an idea, like, right, let's get back to the Roots,
oh, yeah,
Get Back kind of came out of that. It's mad that that just came out of his head when that's the idea of it. That's the genius of McCartney, I think. But Luke, you're a McCartney man, probably more so than me and Brett. Watching this must be like manna from heaven for you.
I felt really emotional watching a lot of McCartney bits. There's loads of McCartney bits that just choked me up a little bit. Seeing him get choked up about stuff, that choked me up. There was a moment where he turned around to the camera and he was like, and then there was two when he was talking about like John wasn't really. John was very absent, and even when he was there, he was quite absent. And McCartney did that. There was that little brief moment where he looked away and he couldn't escape the camera. And you heard his voice shake, and you saw him shake, and he was tearful, and he was obviously with Ringo, but he was proper good again. And at that moment, it was like his world was falling apart, and I felt that, and that was genuine. You could I think you see that bit of video and that bit of footage, that sincerity at its best. It's like there was nowhere to hide. And I think that was the beauty of the way they did it as well. The cameras, I think I heard something where they said that there was only one occasion where they requested that the cameras be turned off and they wanted to have a private conversation, or they wanted to be away. And that's quite a brave thing to do as well, because if you've got the cameras rolling all the time, everything's there, isn't it? But yeah, as you say, from my point of view as a McCartney fan, It's just brilliant, because it's mainly McCartney pushing a project. It's mainly McCartney coming in every morning with some new genius. It was like he was writing a new timeless classic every morning, or coming in with one. And it was just surreal to see it happen.
It's weird, I think, because I don't think if you went, what's McCartney's purple patch, you wouldn't say 1969, probably. If you think about the great McCartney songs, you think about Yesterday and Eleanor Rigby and stuff like that, you probably think about mid-60s. But McCartney at this point is on such a roll with his songwriting and his ideas. And it was only at the end of this entire thing that it kind of made more sense to us. Because I was saying to Brett before you came on, Luke, the first episode kind of annoyed me a bit, because it's just McCartney like fucking doing stuff over and over and over again. Lennon in the first episode in the big Twickenham studios. I mean, he might as well have sent a cardboard cutout. Like, he's disconnected. I think he's disconnected all the way through.
But he's off his tits, isn't he?
Particularly at that point. And what it doesn't go into in the documentary in this film anyway, is that this is meant to be his heroin addiction period.
Yeah.
He doesn't really seem like that much of a junkie, but he's definitely zoned out for whatever reason. In that first episode specifically, George obviously is pissed off in that first episode. So it's all McCartney in that one, really. And Ringo, I think if anybody watches this and doesn't come to the conclusion that Ringo is the greatest drummer of all time, they're a fucking idiot. But
not just the greatest drummer, but one of the nicest, most easygoing
guy. People. What a guy.
He's a lovely guy.
There was times where he was almost just being told, no, Ringo, don't do anything. You're not needed on this bit. And he just sits there. We're like George would sometimes snap back or have a little dig. Ringo just takes whatever comes his way. He plays when he's wanted. He just came across as, just an absolute gem. And yeah, he is an amazing drummer. But I think he was also important as a member, and like the glue that kept them together. And if it wasn't for him, you wonder whether there was even going to be recording at this stage together as a group.
Such a positive influence, I think, on these sessions. Even by not joining in the bickering or whatever, I think he's a positive influence. And I think he's the only person, I think there's one point in this 8.5 hours where McCartney says, maybe do it a bit like this. But everything else, they just trust Ringo to do what he does. And I think that's a massive, massive, like, McCartney's telling Lennon what to play and he's telling George what to play, obviously, which comes into her head. But he never, other than that one little bit, they trust Ringo to do the right thing for the song.
There doesn't seem to be any rehearsal from Ringo. He just does it, doesn't he?
Yeah, and he looks like he's trying not to whitey most of the time. He's so hungover.
Do you think that dislike for the first episode as well, though, or like the annoyance rather? I had a bit of a theory on it. They started on January 2nd. Now, yeah. I know it's not a normal job in the sense that everybody else has, but no one likes going back to work after Christmas and New Year. I imagine at the time they were partying a bit on something such as New Year's Eve.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. The 2nd of January seemed, I know it's like almost due to the Twickenham being available and it being offered to them, but it probably wasn't the best time to start, and the sort of the feeling and the vibes were quite bad from the off, weren't they, at Twickenham?
Also, it was such a hollow space. There was no introduction to the cameras being there. You know, it was like they're on and you're recording like from minute one. There was no like getting used to it or anything like that. No. And I don't blame them for being reticent and standoffish with it and with each other as well as with the whole process, I think.
I mean, even George says, I don't think this is a very acoustically good place.
He says that straight away, doesn't he? Straight away. First morning,
exactly. Yeah, and I think George Martin says the same thing, doesn't he?
Yeah,
I like it when George Martin turns up, because that's one of the things with it. It's basically they'd sacked off George Martin at this point, right? They didn't want to work with him anymore, but obviously they had to bring him in because they needed his little favor to make sure they got a recording in a mixing desk and stuff like that from EMI, because this was a stupid idea. There was no way to record this or whatever, so they needed him. And I think George Martin's excellent in this. Like, I really think he's awesome. Also, I think with George Martin, you think he's always old. He's about 35.
When I know.
In the early 60s, I think he looked older than he is here.
Yeah, I think he looks pretty cool in this, actually. Especially the end where he looks in that hidden camera. I think he looks cool as fuck in that bit. But he comes in, like, basically they've sacked him off and let Glyn Johns run it. And then halfway through, they're like, actually, George, will you? Can you come and help us out a bit? And he seems to do it with good grace and like, but still lets Glyn Johns run the sessions and stuff like that. I think, I mean, Lennon had a lot of bad stuff to say about George Martin after the Beatles split up, especially towards the end of it, where he said he thought he was part of the Beatles and stuff like that and took credit for their success. But I think him being there made everything a little bit more professional just by his presence.
I think he must have had something to do with bringing Billy Preston in, because they're talking about Billy Preston, aren't they? Or we need another member, because
they keep mentioning that other piano player, and it's Nicky Hopkins they're talking about, aren't they?
From the Rolling Stones.
But as soon as Billy comes in, talk about a change. It's like,
this is why the second episode for me is where it all lifts off. And it's always been a thing, right? We've seen the anthology and they're saying that. And when he comes in, it's like, it's basically like you coming in on this podcast. Otherwise, me and Brett
we're on what best behavior.
but when you watch it in the full with a bit more kind of widescreen appreciation of it, fucking hell, I felt myself like the hairs on the back of my neck stood up, and I was a bit.
He's an infectious character, isn't he? All smiles, and I think it really helps that George loves him, George Harrison,
wanted him in, right?
Yeah, so straight away he's all of a sudden got somebody alongside him, an ally. So whereas you've normally obviously got Paul and John doing their own thing and their little in jokes and their little things between the two of them, George needs someone, and he's got Ringo, but like you've said, Ringo is very much in the background, just sort of happily just doing whatever anyone needs of him. I think Billy helps George sort of bring his game up a little bit.
I think it's great for George. George obviously wants him to join. And what I think is, George is the only one of this band that is happy jamming with other people. Like, you know, Paul and John are very...
he's done it with Dylan and Clapton.
Paul and John are very insular, right? They're the little gang. They won't even let George in, so they're never going to let that guy in and that guy in. And there's one point where George says, well, I can ring Dylan up and he can join as well. And Paul's like, but it's enough just us, right? I mean, I don't think that would ever happen, but he wanted Billy in there. They need somebody to play the keys because they can't do both of them because with it being live. And honestly, his appearance just fucking... everyone just loves him when he turns up. And even John, who's obviously at this point is kind of cynical and a bit out of it or a bit out of whack, and he's like really excitedly telling George Martin, we knew him 10 years ago. He was the keyboard player for Little Richard. And he's like really excited telling him. It's nice to see John like excited about something. And I think from that point on, John gets much more into the project and what they're doing.
There's another McCartney bit with Billy as well. Do you know when they first start telling him the songs, and they start playing "I've Got a Feeling," and Billy just all of a sudden he's just sat there, and all of a sudden for the first time he plays the keys over the chorus,
or
the verses. No, that little riff that comes on the offbeats of the lines, yeah. And Paul's face just lights up. He looks really excited.
Yeah. Like, you've got it.
And again, it's a magical moment. It's like, it just, and we've had that before as a band, when not necessarily with somebody else, but when one of us does something that just brings a song to life, it is an amazing feeling. It's almost like magic's just happened. So for a Beatle to look at somebody else and say, "You've just brought that magic alive."
Yeah.
That says something as well, but he's perfect.
And I think one of the great things is he's not like a rival, right? He's not the guy who's played the keyboard for the Rolling Stones. He's not, you know, and I think because he's coming from outside of that whole UK, you know, that R&B kind of scene and that psychedelic scene or whatever they're in right now, I think that helps, because if Nicky Hopkins did come in, it would be session, you're in, you're out. Thanks very much, Nicky. I think that's my opinion of it.
Yeah.
But because Billy comes into the norm, there's just that great little bit where they're saying, "So is he going to come back tomorrow?" And they're like, "Well, I hope so. I think he will." He's like,
"Who's going to pay him?" Yeah.
I mean,
talk about luck as well. Talk about luck being on your side. For him to turn up in the UK he was doing an interview, wasn't he? But then to also just be able to say, "Oh yeah, I can give you the next 2 weeks of my life," and he just.
Yeah.
It seems to always be there.
Well, I
still a black show or something like that, wasn't he? And that's what he was there for.
Yeah.
But I just thought it was very strange that they were talking about him and then he arrived.
Then he just turned up.
You know, it's somebody, and I imagine that it's probably George
Mal.
Martin.
Well, it would have been Mal Evans.
Or maybe it's Mal. It could have been Mal, is great.
I've written down a list of like peripheral people in this. And if we don't talk about that, I'm going to ask you about like each of them. But Mal is on that list because who knew all the stuff that he did? Like, I knew Mal Evans was a big, you know, he's a big part of the Beatles story. I didn't know he wrote the words down for them when they were saying
them.
I know,
yeah.
He seems to be the only one as well, along with George Martin, that can turn around and say whatever he wants to another Beatle and get instant respect back.
Yeah.
Other people sometimes try it, and either the Beatles will ignore them or they'll take it on board, but the person maybe doesn't say exactly the sort of honest truth.
But
Mal and George can just say it how it is, and that's fine, because they're both one of them, aren't they? So,
Neil Aspinall's only in this for a short part of a piece of time.
Yeah.
But I think he's probably in that group as well, but he's not really a big part of this film. But yeah, I think Mal, like, he's what a lovable guy. But yeah, who knew that they just read out the words when they read out the words and he would write them down and type them up?
Hammer as well, doesn't he? We need a hammer and an anvil, Mal.
Also, there's the point where Paul's starting to write "The Long and Winding Road," and he's going, "Oh, I think you should say 'Lead It to Your Door.'"
Yeah, he's helping him out. Isn't he?
I'm like, and Paul's going, "Yeah, I think you're right there." Like, and I was like, "What the fuck?" Like, I didn't know
that
happened. Like,
anybody else, I don't think they'd have got the time of day with that opinion going in there. But yeah, Paul takes things on board.
That bit with Glyn Johns where he says to John, "Turn the bass down on your guitar," and John just looks at Paul and he's like,
Someone's telling them what to do here. Yeah.
He doesn't. I think the main thing is he doesn't know how to do it. I think that's the thing.
But, there's also Alan Parsons in there as well, isn't there? From the Alan Parsons Project.
He's
in there as well, did you not see him?
No, I didn't see him.
Which bit was that?
Where did
he in? He's in with Glyn Johns for a little bit in the second episode. Alan Parsons Project, he is. Didn't I see him?
I missed that.
For me, right, I like the first one because it shows that creative process, them just sitting down. I know John Lennon's out of it completely, but it's got the McCartney bit where he's just making up "Get Back," which I just think is watching like a flash of genius. Do you know what I mean?
Absolutely
it
incredible.
Just took me breath away when I watched that bit. So that bit's in it. It's got all the other bits, the funny bits in it. for example, you know, the boat and stuff like that. And then it's got the bit that Luke was talking about as well, where George does leave and you can see McCartney's eyes filling up. There's all that different stuff in the first episode.
You know, I think it's weird that they just carry on after he leaves.
Well, they just get clapping in, wouldn't they? That's what John Lennon says.
I think George says that before he leaves. He's like, I'll leave, you just get clapping on someone to replace us, I'll see you later. But I think
the thing is, they're very flippant about him leaving first off, aren't they?
Yeah, and then about an hour later,
it's a big deal.
I think it's almost like they saw it coming. They see it coming, though, probably. Yeah. And you've got to remember, working in a studio with someone like that for all the years they did, he might have done that on every single project. And it's like 2 hours later, he'd be back in or whatever. So they were thinking, well, he'll be back in a minute. It's George.
Uh-huh. You know what I mean? Well, Ringo did it in the White Album. I'm pretty sure George did it in the White Album as well. But obviously, they were all kind of writing, recording a bit separately in that. So I think the main thing for me with this project is I don't think they ever recorded an album in this way, live, rehearsed it, come up with the songs on the spot, rehearsed them, and then made them. Lennon McCartney would have gone, here's our five songs for this or six songs for this. This is your bit. This is your bit. Let's play them. Mm-hmm. And this is the first time, and I think there's a bit where George is like, oh, yeah, I'm really getting into this. This is the longest I've ever played the guitar for. My fingers are getting loose. I'm really getting into it. And you can see when George comes back, his confidence just grows and grows and grows. And there's that bit where he plays For You Blue. And you can see him, he's like kind of like little embarrassed, like cheeks when he's singing it. And you can see him like flushed with pride that he's actually playing along live in a recording setting with these guys, and they're finally accepting them. And I think as it goes on, one of the main things that I love about it is at the beginning when George is going, well, I think you should like play these chords, or maybe the guitar should be a little bit more choppy like these soul songs. And McCartney's like, you know what you're talking about, fuck off. By the end of it, he's absolutely an equal part of how these songs sound, even if he didn't write them.
But the thing is, with George, he's got loads of ideas, hasn't he? He's coming in every day with a song that he's written overnight or whatever, because he's been watching a sci-fi program on the TV and stuff. He's coming in with loads of stuff. Lennon, not particularly, as he hasn't got a lot of ideas.
I think Lennon's like the least, he's the least engaged in this, even less than Ringo, I think.
George is a little bit apologetic, though, in the way he presents a song or presents an idea. So he comes in and it's almost like he gives the impression that he doesn't fully believe in it. And I think he always believed in it, but I don't think he believed maybe that it was the right time or whether this was the right
setting. I mean, that's understandable, right? Like, you've got
Of course it is, yeah.
And there is that bit, and it's not the famous bit where he's going, I'll just play what you want us to play. There's a bit where he's saying, well, maybe the guitar should be like this. And McCartney just looks at him and just blanks him and starts talking to John again in that first episode. Now I'm like, fucking hell, no wonder he walked out like that.
I think George does, to me, George comes across as, I think what the film did, it sort of highlighted the things I already knew, or the things I already thought I knew about each individual. Yeah, yeah. The thing with George is I thought George was sometimes probably a little bit hard work, and the way he could be a bit whinging, a bit moany.
Yeah, yeah, I agree.
But at the same time, I know exactly why he was like that. I understand it. I wish he wasn't always that way, and I wish sometimes he did have a bit more of a positive spin. But at the same time, he was playing second fiddle to the best two songwriters that have ever existed, and even now, 50 years later, still have ever existed. He had the impossible task, didn't he?
He did. There's another bit where George, I think it's I, Me, Mine or something like that, he's playing. And he says to them all, well, I don't fucking care for you if you don't want it. Do you know what I mean? he's not forceful. He's not saying, I want this to be on the album or anything like that.
He realises you guys are going to do what you want. I'm bringing me songs in. And he does get empowered a little bit more. But also there's that bit towards the end when he says, you know, I've got loads of songs because I've been writing them.
Yeah.
And if I'm going to have two on an album, I'm going to have enough songs for the next 10 years or the next 10 albums, whatever it is. Mm-hmm. And he went, but maybe I'll just do my own album and write, get them all down. And he's and again,
Yogo goes, yeah, that's a good idea.
Do it, yeah.
He
keeps saying, I didn't know if that was his way. I didn't know if that was his way of trying to get John to say, oh no, come on,
we'll do some more of yours.
So, yeah. I think it's a shame that like All Things Must Pass wasn't on this album. And little things like that. I do like the album. You wonder whether, like, just one little tweak like that with adding that on, whether it would have just elevated it to just another level.
Luke, Teddy Boy was in serious consideration for this album.
I like Teddy Boy.
But
All Things Must Pass wasn't.
But yes, it should have been on there, because All Things Must Pass is George's version of a Let It Be, a Hey Jude, or a Long and Winding Road.
It's on that sort of. And you've got fucking Paul just singing nonsense Teddy Boy shit. I hate that song, but okay. but you've got to agree that in the grand scheme of things, he's going, hey, do you want to hear this? And Paul's like, well, actually, I've got this one. And it's not even got to
ring. It should have been on there. But again, that's where maybe he should have been a bit more forceful, because they did play it a few times and they were working at it. Mm-hmm. And I think the thing that I find interesting on that bit is when they are rehearsing it, McCartney's really going for it on the harmonies and the backing vocals. It's not like he's not bothered. I think when they're doing something and when they're trying something, even if it's George's, they give it their all. But for whatever reason, it didn't then get pushed enough. Well, and George says, this has got to be on it.
I think from my point of view, McCartney tries to overpower everything that anybody brings in all of these sessions, and I think that's because he's the driving force in it, and he's coming up
because if he wasn't doing that, nobody else would. I agree, but I think when other people bring in the songs,
I think he kind of oversteps the mark a little bit on other people's songs a bit. Like, he's always doing the daft voices on the backing vocals, or he's like, honestly, that like kind of high harmony he's trying out all the way through, like, really pisses us off to a point. And then you get to the end and you hear the finished songs and you realize that he's actually spent 20 days working out what his best voice is for each of these songs. Uh-huh. The other guys don't have that. Lennon sings like Lennon. George sings like George. McCartney has a different voice for different material. And it's really annoying to me for that rehearsal process, hearing him like stamp all over people's songs with these different harmonies and stuff like that. But the finished article absolutely makes it worth it, because he nails it in the end. And when you hear those finished vocals, whether on the rough takes or whatever, or the live versions, he gets it, which is the genius of McCartney, I think.
Yeah.
And I think that's partly where the argument comes from as well, isn't it? Like, if Paul McCartney saying, I want to get my bits sorted before you do your bits.
Yeah, because I know what my bits are, so I'm going to do them. And you, like, follow suit. Luke, we're about to end this episode and come back in about 15 minutes. You've got 30 seconds to introduce the B-side of your latest single.
The B-side. So this is quite an old recording from about 4 or 5 years ago. It's a quick 1:30 pocket rocket. It's called Don't Ask Once.
And it's very Beatlesy, so thanks. It works perfectly. Cheers. Well, we're going to switch off. We'll see you soon.
Some things come back to haunt you both in night and in day. Take Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.